They are one of the largest recipients of NIH funding. Their scientists played a substantial role in developing more than half the cancer drugs approved by the FDA in the last 5 years. Dana-Farber Cancer Institute has been making one advanced cancer discovery after another for over 75 years. At Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, what we do here changes lives everywhere. Find out more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Chaos, corruption, and economic collapse, Brazil is having a Monday. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In San Francisco, I'm Molly Wood, filling in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, March 21st. Glad you could join us. We'll start today south of the border, not in Cuba. We'll get there in just a bit. In Brazil, where South America's largest economy is in free fall. The country has been rocked by a multi-billion dollar scandal involving the state-run oil company. And over the weekend, polls showed that almost 70% of Brazilians would like to impeach the country's president. For more on the tumult in Brazil, here's Wira Davies, who covers South America for the BBC. Hi, Wira. How are you?
I'm pretty good. How are you?
I'm well. Let's start with impeachment. That was sort of the big move over the weekend. Why is there this move afoot to impeach President Dilma Rousseff?
It gets technical here because the actual legal issue on which Dilma Rousseff might be impeached refers to the way she is alleged to have reported the Brazilian budget before the last election.
So for all of the conversation about corruption with the state petroleum business, Petrobras, is that somewhat unrelated to the impeachment efforts?
Technically, Dilma would not be impeached on the corruption scandal looking into Petrobras. Now, that is massive. That involves more than $2 billion in kickbacks. This is by far the biggest corruption scandal ever to have hit Brazil, a country where corruption is endemic. But the technicalities are that Dilma Rousseff is actually, her impeachment is being sought in Congress on a different issue. For the wider public, it doesn't matter. The big protests we saw in Rio de Janeiro and São Paulo against the government and the pro-government protests that we saw are all to do with this tug of war between people who want to see the Workers' Party removed from government and people who say that the Workers' Party, however unpopular they may be, they should be allowed to see out the remaining 2 years of her presidency.
And to what extent is this a fight between the economic classes in Brazil?
That's a really good point. I mean, 10 years ago, Brazil was the darling of the developing world, you know, a country with mega growth, not just based on exports of commodities to China, but Brazil was training its own engineers. Brazil had its own multinational companies. There were impressive social policies that dragged 40 million Brazilians out of poverty. So it wasn't a surprise that the PT, the Workers' Party government, was re-elected three times over. 10 years on, all of that has faded away amid this huge corruption scandal, an economic crisis. This is an almost unrecognizable country from where it was 10 years ago.
Right. Brazil was really a shining star, an example of economic improvement, doing so well. What else happened? How did this collapse?
Well, they didn't really develop on that. As I say, you know, 40 million people were brought out of poverty. They immediately became consumers. So the internal market in Brazil grew. It gave it like a turbo boost to the economy. But they didn't move on from that. You know, this is still a very inefficient country. There's a lot of protectionism here. Trying to set up a company here is a ridiculously complicated process. And the falling oil price has affected Brazil's biggest company, Petrobras. Add to that a corruption scandal involving that company, Petrobras, and some of Brazil's biggest construction companies. And the whole thing has slowed down. There's a political crisis, there's an economic crisis, and there's a crisis at the center of government. And all of those are really hitting the government hard.
That's Wira Davies, South America correspondent for the BBC. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
On Wall Street today, almost as much chaos. We'll have all the details when we do the numbers. The The drama in the pharmaceutical sector over profits and pricing isn't slowing down at all. One of the nation's largest insurers, Anthem, announced today that it's suing the pharmacy benefits manager Express Scripts for $15 billion, claiming Express Scripts is overcharging for drugs. Then there's Valeant. Holy cow, is there ever Valeant. Just today alone, the company announced that its current CEO is stepping down, a big-name investor is joining the board of directors, and its financial future is in question. Not great news for Valeant investors, but possibly good news for all of us who buy prescription drugs. From the health desk at WHYY in Philadelphia, Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein reports.
The Kaiser Family Foundation found recently 7 out of 10 Americans believe drug companies worry more about profit than patients. Enter Valeant Pharmaceuticals.
What Valeant is doing is buy somebody else's research, put it in a new bow, try to make it pretty, and then jacking up the price.
That's Johns Hopkins economist Gerard Anderson. In one instance, Valeant raised the price of a heart medication 500% in one day. Bloomberg intelligence analyst Liz Krutoholow says to make money, Valeant aggressively raises prices.
If you look at a specialty pharma company, they have price increases maybe 9% per year. And Valeant, in most cases, was looking at, 9 to 10% per quarter.
For a while, Valeant rode the wave of Wall Street love, but Congress started asking questions about its business model. Insurers pushed back, and large employers balked.
You can't just jack up your prices and expect coverage on them.
Today, Valeant shares are trading for about $30, down more than 90% from this past summer. Harvard's Meredith Rosenthal says it's a warning sign to would-be Valeants.
While we expect pharmaceutical companies to behave like for-profit companies, really on the edges, we don't.
At some level, she says, there's this unspoken agreement that it's okay to make money. Hell, lots of money. But if it seems to cross from profit to greed, that's not tolerated, even in our healthcare system where we pay more for drugs than anywhere else. I'm Dan Gorenstein for Marketplace.
And now we bring you news of a $9 billion acquisition in an industry we don't cover very often, but it is surely an important one, the business of paint. Sherwin-Williams, a historic brand based in the industrial Midwest, is buying another of the same kind, Valspar. But they are in different segments of the paint market, so as ANSI investors demand more growth from all companies, this tie-up could provide that shiny new coat they're hoping for. Marketplace's Scott Tong reports.
The Sherwin-Williams logo famously says, "Cover the Earth." Though to date, the company has mostly just covered North America. Its old but proven model is to open some 4,000 stores in the U.S. and target a particular customer. Here's analyst Mike Harrison at Seaport Global Securities.
Where they really have a very strong presence is with the paint contractors, kind of the local store, no matter where you're doing a job, that you can get your brushes, your paint, your drop cloths, etc.
Sherwin-Williams incorporated in Cleveland 132 years ago. Valspar, based in Minneapolis, goes back to 1804. Its product coated ship masts and the spirit of St. Louis. But lately, it's targeted homeowners, says Dimitri Silverstein at Longbow Research.
Valspar is a dominant supplier of paint to Lowe's, for example, and also has products at Ace Hardware. It helps them with reaching the do-it-yourself customer for paint.
And Valspar has a bigger presence globally and in the industrial sector. So they complement. They don't drip on each other's business too much. It's a slow and a steady business. And Eric Linick at IHS Chemical says these days, Wall Street demands more.
You either have to do some acquisition work, like what's going on now, or expand outside typical regions and go into areas like China.
The Asia market is where the growth is. The challenge now for Sherwin-Williams is its China branding. The current translation, Xian Wei Wei Lian Mu Si, sounds a little clunky. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Adjunct faculty or non-tenure track faculty are basically part-time instructors on college campuses. They make very little money and have very little job security, but they also make up the majority of staff at U.S. colleges and universities. So there's a good chance they're teaching your kids. And now they're at the heart of a new kind of union movement. The latest step came Friday when the adjunct faculty at Duke decided to unionize, and instructors at dozens of other schools have done the same. Marketplace's Mark Garrison has more from New York.
called contingent, non-tenure track, or adjunct professors. They average about $3,000 a class, meaning they earn $18,000 a year with a typical course load. That's compared to a median salary of nearly $70,000 for entry-level tenure track faculty. They're doing more and more of the teaching, so these adjunct faculty see a disconnect between their pricey advanced degrees and relatively small paychecks, often with minimal job security. I reached Eileen Anderson on Duke's campus just before she taught her Spanish 203 class. She thinks universities can afford to pay adjuncts a little more.
I don't think that's a problem, especially in a place like Duke. It's such a large endowment. We're just talking about living wages and cost of living increases.
But in an era where higher education funding is scarcer, something has to give.
But I believe it's going to end up doing more damage than good.
Historian Philip Magnus is with the Institute for Humane Studies at George Mason University. He's sympathetic to adjunct professors' concerns because he's been in their shoes, but he's generally against them unionizing.
Universities have scarce resources. If we put that money into more adjunct salaries, that means money is less available for tuition relief.
Or scholarships. Or it could mean fewer jobs for adjuncts and larger class sizes, all bad for students. Alternatively, a school that pays more could attract more talented teachers, improving the classroom experience and lifting the university's fortune overall. We'll see in years to come as we compare results of union versus non-union schools. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
If this next story were a New Yorker cartoon, it would show President Obama shaking hands with Raul Castro in Cuba and a crowd of would-be tourists in shorts and binoculars, plus the entire American travel industry peeking over their shoulders. You're welcome, you guys. You can have that one. Now, as diplomatic relations ease and even Airbnb has set up shop in Cuba, the tourism industry is set to invade the island nation in force. The BBC's Vivian Nunes reports on whether Cuba is ready.
Havana's famous Prado runs from one end of the city to the other. It is a wide boulevard designed with a beautiful park in the center. Its streets are lined with fine shops.
Those fine shops are long gone. Instead, tourists today flock to see the city's crumbling architectural gems. Blanca Rodriguez has been renting out rooms in her house in Old Havana for 5 years.
In the past 2 years, tourism has really been booming. We're really busy. I think that once the news broke about diplomatic ties being restored between the United States and Cuba, it led to a huge increase in tourism.
Lots of tourists think that Cuba is going to change when the relationship with America improves, but do you think they're right or wrong?
Yo creo que es bueno.
For us, it's good news the Americans come and get to know Cuba, and for us to get to know American people. We have no complaint against them. And we haven't any bad feelings despite all the years the trade and economic embargo went on. We know it's not the people's fault. It was the fault of the governments. So we're really pleased if many more American tourists keep coming to get to know our country.
Blanca Rodriguez isn't the only one looking forward to an increase in US visitors. Robin Hayes is the CEO of JetBlue.
When we think about the potential for Havana and Cuba, it's really vast. It could easily become the largest market in the Caribbean.
And the American aviation industry is vying for access to the new route.
You know, this is the biggest route decision-making process the Department of Transportation in the U.S. has ever had. So all the airlines are fighting amongst themselves to get into Havana, including JetBlue, because it's such a great opportunity for all of us.
So is this the end of Cuba's distinctly non-American flavor? That's certainly the view of some U.S. tourists I met.
Yeah, I knew that if I waited a year or so that the culture or the tourist impact could vastly change what you see and what you experience.
Even now, I can see a lot of changes. It will change very much. Hopefully the Cuban people are prepared for it and will be prepared for it so they won't be overrun. But it's going to be a challenging time for them.
Cuban people are not going to change. We have our own culture, our own identity, our musical roots and own quirks.
Tomarse una Coca-Cola no va a cambiar mi cultura.
Drinking a Coke or eating a McDonald's is not going to change the way I am. It's not going to change our identity.
That report was by Vivian Nunes of the BBC. Coming up,
there's a lot of people who aren't able to spend their time at work well. And I've been that person in the past. And you can't get that time back.
What this guy can teach companies about staying productive at work. But first, let's do the numbers. Numbers are up after an up-down day. The Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 21 points, a tenth percent, to finish at 17,623. The NASDAQ rose 13 points, a quarter percent, to close at 4,808. The S&P 500 gained 2 points, a tenth percent, to end the day at 2051. Paint maker Valspar spruced up more than 23% after news of the $9 billion deal we told you about earlier. Sherwin-Williams faded 5 1/3%, however. In other deal news, data company Market is merging with analytics provider IHS in a $13 billion deal. Starwood Hotels and Resorts Worldwide shined up 4.5% after agreeing to be bought by rival hotel firm Marriott International. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.91%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
You're listening to Marketplace. I'm Molly Wood. Back to the business of medicine for a bit. The holy grail in healthcare is finding a way to cut costs and improve outcomes. Researchers at Parkland Hospital in Dallas say they've uncovered a way to do both and let patients who would typically have to spend more than a month in the hospital go home and care for themselves. From Dallas, Lauren Silverman reports the program could save hospitals money and give patients some independence.
Warren J. Smith III didn't want to lose his leg, but an infection just kept coming back. It all started with a motorcycle accident. Since then, he'd had dozens of operations and spent countless days in a hospital bed, isolated in sterile rooms.
I mean, it's like the kid in the plastic bubble. Remember that movie? I'm showing my age now.
At 49, out of his job in sales, Smith ended up at Parkland Hospital for another round of antibiotics. For uninsured folks like Smith, a full course of antibiotics often means being stuck in the hospital for weeks, sometimes a month, or a stay in assisted living. An experimental program at Parkland tried a third option. It sent patients like Smith home with the tools to treat themselves.
Those are my gloves. This is the little saline.
Every night for a month, Smith would connect the IV bag to a small tube coming out of a vein in his arm, right below his bicep. To get the medicine to drip in, he rigged together an IV pole.
I would have, like, a hanger.
Smith would hang the metal hanger with the IV bag on a lamp or picture frame above his desk. He didn't have to be in the hospital, and he felt free.
So having the IVs and administering at home gave me that self-confidence of that I'm still somewhat in control.
He did all this without any problems, and other uninsured Parkland Hospital patients were doing it as well, nearly 1,000 of them. Dr. Kavita Bhavan ran the Parkland study. She says they were wildly successful.
And not only do they do it well, but they've done it better in our study when we looked at the controls who went home with some home health services.
Bhavan says there was a safety net, weekly checkups, and a 24-hour hotline. Still, the results of the 4-year study challenge traditional ideas about what patients are capable of.
Most physicians will tell you we didn't think that could be done.
Some educated, insured patients have been safely using IVs at home for years. But this group of patients was different. Many were far below the poverty line. Some were even homeless. To teach patients, a group of nurses, doctors, and social care workers did bedside training. In 2015, the hospital saved more than $7 million and made 6,000 hospital bed days available. Those savings caught Dr. Keith Kay's attention. He's corporate director of infection prevention at the Detroit Medical Center.
I think if you're looking at big urban populations, Detroit, New York, Chicago, L.A., I would imagine that there could be similar programs that will sprout up in the near future.
Kay says the tricky part is careful patient selection and monitoring. Back in Dallas, Warren Smith III successfully completed his treatment, but an infection came back and surgeons had to amputate his left leg. Still, he says he learned about his own body.
So I think for me and what I try to tell other people, you know, you have to be willing to try.
This is just one program, so nobody knows yet if the results can be duplicated elsewhere. But the key, Smith and Dr. Bavon agree, is for doctors and healthcare workers to collaborate with patients. In Dallas, I'm Lauren Silverman for Marketplace.
Sometimes in the working world, it is easier to talk about doing things than to actually get anything done. But if you operate that way as a startup, your company could be dead before you ever make a product. So at GV, the venture capital division of Alphabet, formerly known as Google, they're perfecting a way to get ideas and products off the ground quickly, and they're using it to help the startups in their portfolio, like Nest, Angie's List, Slack, a little company called Uber. The method is called a sprint. It's a 5-day challenge with a specific agenda and the goal to produce a prototype by Friday. Jake Knapp is an advisor at GV. He's a former designer at Google and the creator of Google Hangouts. And he wrote a book on how to use the sprint method at any company. He's here now to talk about it. Hi, Jake.
Hey, Molly. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, thanks for coming on. So tell me if you will, and it feels like you should be good at making this concise.
We'll see.
How do I do a 5-day sprint?
Well, what you're going to do is start with a big problem, a big challenge. You're going to get a team together, clear the week, and follow the steps that are in the book. And by the end, you'll have a realistic prototype. You'll put it in front of 5 of your target customers, and you'll get some data. So by Friday afternoon, you'll know what to do next.
The sprint itself is a week, but in reading this, it seems like a lot of prep must go into setting up that week, right?
You know, actually not. If you pick the right folks, so you get your team together, and if you clear the week, then you don't need to prepare beforehand. You just need to get everyone in the room and do the steps.
Well, then let's talk about the team. It seems like it would be, and it's clear in your book that this process is heavily dependent on picking the right team. Can you talk a little bit about that? What makes a team be able to work together without getting bogged down?
Well, one key is to have the decision maker in the room. You're not going to have to debate. You can just turn to the decision maker and say, make the call. You know, when we've got 2 or 3 or 10 or 12 competing ideas, make the call. But for the rest of your team, you just want a bunch of diverse skill sets, and they're going to have competing solutions. And that's really healthy. That's going to help you come to a better conclusion.
How broadly do you think these principles could be applied? I mean, should Congress try to get the two sides closer together by doing a 5-day sprint?
Yeah. Oh, man, I would love to watch that. I've been really surprised by how broadly it's been applied. When we first started doing it at GV, it was the same thing. We were doing it with consumer products. And then I started blogging about it and started hearing from teams that were doing the sprint process. And recently heard from an English teacher who was using a sprint with his class to have the kids explore, you know, different topics for a paper on Hamlet before they wrote it. I don't know exactly what you'll do, but we've seen a lot of examples where people have said, yeah, you know, I can 3D print that part, or I can modify this existing, you know, piece of equipment that we have. If you have the right mindset going into it, apparently you can apply it quite broadly.
So you now work for GV, the venture capital division within
right.
Alphabet. You're the guy who helps startups grow. Why do you want to give away your hard-won secret to productivity here?
Yeah, perhaps it will prove to be a huge mistake. You know, I think it's, I don't know, there's a lot of people who aren't able to spend their time at work well. And I've been that person in the past. And you can't get that time back. And we've had a really unique opportunity at GV to work with all these startups, and we get to experiment over and over and over and you know, have found something that works. So I feel like it would be wrong to not try to share it. And it sounds kind of corny, but if, you know, I think people should have the chance to use their time well. And so that's what the book is there for. And if it puts me out of a job, then so be it.
More books.
Yeah.
Jake Knapp is the co-author of Sprint, How to Solve Big Problems and Test New Ideas in Just 5 Days. Jake, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It was really fun.
This final note before we go, if you were going to do all your March Madness fantasy wagering on DraftKings or FanDuel, you're out of luck in the state of New York. The sites have agreed to stop operating there as part of a deal to get the state attorney general to drop almost all the claims against them. Now, instead of getting sued out of existence completely, DraftKings and FanDuel will appeal a ruling that they violate online gambling laws, and they'll wait for the outcome of a proposed bill in New York that would legalize daily fantasy sports betting. New York is the 9th state where these sites had to stop offering paid contests, but it's extra painful because not only is the New York market huge for both of them, FanDuel actually has its corporate headquarters right there on Union Square in Manhattan. All right, that's our program, and we are out of here. Today, the Dow was up 21 points, a 10th percent. The NASDAQ rose 13 points, a 0.25%. And the S&P 500, 2 points, a 10th percent. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bodner, Jenny Josephson, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Molly Wood. We'll be right back here again tomorrow. This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.